CRM.
Welcome to Nature Bets Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.fm. This October the 1st, 2019 edition, episode 131 of Nature Bets Last, comes to you from Rakino Island in Aotearoa and also from Winchester County, New York in the United States. This is Kevin Hester. And I'm again joined today by my co-host, Professor Guy McPherson. Today's show includes with journalist Robert Hunziker. Guy, would you do the honors for introducing Robert, please?
Thank you, Kevin. Robert Hunziker is a freelance writer and environmental journalist whose articles have been translated into foreign languages and appeared in more than 50 journals, magazines, and websites worldwide. These include the European Project on Ocean Acidification, Counterpunch, Dissident Voice, UK Progressive, and many, many more. Robert has been interviewed on several radio stations as well. We will be taking your toll-free calls today. Please call us with your questions and comments after we spend a bit of time with our guest. We are most easily reached with a toll-free telephone call to 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
Welcome to the show, Robert. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi, Kevin. Hi, Guy.
Hi. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for giving us your valuable time.
Robert. Great. I've been writing articles about climate change now for over a decade, and I've come to the conclusion after a lot of work that the year 2000 serves as an inflection point for climate change. And post-2000, it's altered everything on the planet. You're getting rapid, abrupt, threatening climate change that, in fact, I think could change current lifestyles and civilization as we know it. Now, what I'd like to do, I kind of have an agenda for you if you guys want me to do this, but I kind of like to ramble on and feel free at any time to interrupt or ask questions or whatever you think is necessary. But here's how I'd like to do it. I have some vignettes or some kind of thumbnail short stories of some thumbnail sketches of some radical climate change I want to give you first, very quickly. Then I'd like to hit on three hot spots on the planet. And those three hot spots I would entitle the following way. The Barents Sea is sending SOS signals, and this has everything to do with methane. Number two hotspot is evidence of collapsing food webs, and we'll talk about that, and that's pretty grotesque, by the way. And then finally, the third hotspot is Fukushima, the biggest time bomb in history. And I've written extensively about all of these. Fukushima, I think I have 25, 30 articles out. But at any rate, in terms of the 2000-year inflection point, please keep that in mind as I talk here. because let's start with Greenland this last summer of 2019. Normally, Greenland, as the Earth tilts and the sun starts to flow more onto that latitude, normally about 10% of that ice sheet hits a melting point. This summer, it was 50%. And there's a climate scientist named Fetwes, who made the statement that the volume and intensity today is on par with what the models predicted for the year 2050. So Greenland is 30 years ahead of schedule. Does that mean climate change is 30 years ahead of schedule? But watch this. Watch this. Greenland has 12 glacial flow zones. One of the larger ones is called the Helheim Glacier. Now, the Helheim Glacier has been rock solid. I mean the Rock of Gibraltar from 1950 to the year 2000. Guess what's happened since the year 2000? Once again, this inflection point. Since 2000, it's no longer rock solid. It's lost 5 miles of ice, and this summer, not only has it lost 5 miles of ice, a 4-mile-wide iceberg broke off. So that iceberg right now is floating around and melting off the east coast of Greenland. Now I want to go to the Canadian High Arctic. I wrote an article, Permafrost Collapses 70 Years Early. And in that article, I started it off by saying, fasten your seatbelt, global warming is on a rampage. And believe you me, it is. Here's another one of these post-2000 inflection points. There's a scientific study that was done in this area in the Canadian High Arctic from 2003 to 2016. Let me tell you the results of that study. The permafrost is thawing 240% more rapid than all previous years. By the way, this area had been frozen solid as the Rock of Gibraltar for thousands of years. Now, the scientists find that the landscape has collapsed by 3 feet. So here's a quote from one of the scientists on this field trip. Observed maximum thaw depths at our sites are already exceeding the project to occur by the year 2090. Well, this one's 70 years ahead of schedule. Is global warming 70 years ahead of schedule? I don't know. Sure sounds like it to me. By the way, the top 25% of the Northern Hemisphere is permafrost. And it's the predominant feature. And frankly, it's coming apart at the seams. People should be very concerned. I have the notion that the public doesn't really have a handle on what's happening. How could they with what's out in the mainstream news? You really have to drill down into these things to find out what's happening. That's what we're doing right now. We're going to drill down into three of them. Here's another permafrost story I want to mention to you. It was in Nature magazine in May of this year. And Merritt Turitsky, who's the Canadian research chair, experienced an unbelievable rapid collapse, a transformation right before their eyes, because in the areas where they work, they had to keep moving their field site every few months. Normally, it was every several years, because once again, permafrost was collapsing almost under their feet, by the way. Here's another snippet I want to give you that should make everybody shake in their boots a little bit. There was a new study that came out about nitrous oxide in the Arctic permafrost. All this permafrost is thawing, right? Guess one of the greenhouse gases coming out that a new study looked into? It's called nitrous oxide. Now, when people talk about the greenhouse gases, they all think CO2, carbon dioxide. That's kind of just the discussion point because that's only 80, 85% of the greenhouse gases. You have other ones like methane, nitrous oxide. This new study came out. And what it said was you have huge quantities of nitrous oxide in the permafrost, like 67 billion tons, they're guessing. But here's the thing about nitrous oxide. It's 300 times more potent than CO2, and it lasts 120 years in the atmosphere. So the Wilkerson study, and that's the name of the scientist on this, said that the nitrous oxide is being released 12 times faster than all expectations. Guess what? Post the year 2000. There's that big inflection point once again. Now, I want to talk about Antarctica for a minute, and then I'll talk about the Amazon for 1 minute, and then I'll go to these three major stories I want to talk about. But the Antarctica, especially East Antarctica, This is extremely concerning. The glacial flow there is spiking up big time. In fact, exponentially. But for years, as long as I can remember, and I first got interested in this topic when James Hansen testified before the Senate in 1988 and said they detected human influence of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And we've always heard that East Antarctica, that's the Rock of Gibraltar. I mean, that's 3 miles of ice. It's the average temperature's minus 65 year-round, blah, blah, blah. Well, Eric Rigneau is the leading scientist in the world and on Antarctica. He's with the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab, and he's been responsible for some really groundbreaking research on glacial ice. He spoke before the National Academies in Washington, D.C., about the status of Antarctica and sea level rise this year. And let me tell you what his opening sentence was. I think this is very telling. He said, "I don't think you need to run for the hills, but I would walk." You don't want to hear that. I mean, you know, with a guy with his kind of respect, that's a pretty bold statement to make. Here's the numbers he gave them at this speech on East Antarctica in terms of glacial flow and the acceleration. What he gave them was the total mass loss. So I'm going to give you four different decade cycles. 1979, 1990, it was flowing at the rate of 40 gigatons per year. The next 10-year cycle, 1989 to the year 2000, 50 gigatons per year, came up a little bit. Watch this. 1999 to 2009, 166 gigatons per year. It tripled. There you go, that inflection point, the year 2000 again. That's when the turbocharged climate kicks into gear, and now we're smoking. Then watch this, 2009, 2017, 252 gigatons per year. This is starting to look like an exponential function. In fact, there's a scientist who made the statement a long time ago that the biggest failing of humanity is the failure to understand the exponential function. Because it just did a real quick few seconds explanation, it kind of works like this. How long does it take to fill Yankee Stadium with water if you have an exponential function at work? And you put in one drop the first minute, the second minute you put in two drops, the third minute you put in four drops, then eight, then 16. So you get the point every minute. How many minutes would it take to fill Yankee Stadium with water? Now, John Englander, who is a specialist on sea level rise, spoke to the London Institute some months ago and used an example similar to this. And one of the physicists in the crowd said, "Well, how big's the first drop?" Which is a great question he didn't have the answer to. Nevertheless, it takes 47 minutes. 47 minutes. That's an exponential function. We don't want that to happen in our climate system. We don't want to see exponential numbers by the decade. That's what we're seeing in East Antarctica, which is the mother of all ice. Now, I also want to talk for a minute about James Lovelock, who's the father of the Gaia theory, because I wrote an article about him. He turned 100 years old July 26th, so I wrote an article about him. I'm fascinated by this man. He was started with NASA in the 1960s to discover life on Mars, and instead, he didn't find life on Mars, but he found the Gaia theory, which really says that the Earth is a single self-regulating organism that maintains favorable conditions for life. Well, I listen to him when he talks because in large measure, he has no axe to grind. He's an independent scientist for 50 years, and he's very active to this day. In fact, he walks 5 miles a day. And I heard him in an interview with the BCC about a year ago. And I listened to him once again because, as I said, he doesn't have anybody he has to report to. And here's what he said. He said, "The Earth is in dire trouble and could soon experience intense climate-related disasters." Well, that's what we're talking about right now. Now, I want to talk for a minute about the Amazon, and then I'm going to go on to these three hotspots. Because the Amazon's really been in the news recently with the Bolsonaro government. It's not only the Bolsonaro government, it's other governments that are rainforest, that control the rainforest, are doing the same thing. But here's something that's a shocker. Now, once again, post-2000, the rainforest in the Amazon has experienced Three, what they classify as 100-year droughts have hit the Amazon rainforest like clockwork, 2005, 2010, 2015, over only 10 years. So much for 100-year droughts. Looks like 5-year droughts to me. And here's the problem. Number one, this is unprecedented. Okay? And the other problem is this. Normally, in the past, when you've had these droughts in the rainforest, it's had plenty of time to replenish, to refresh, to regrow. The regrowth comes back pretty quickly. The science, what they've found now, and it's a major concern, is it can't do that refreshing, replenishing, regrowing the way it used to, because these things are coming too close together. Three 100-year droughts in a period of 10 years. That is a stunning fact. Not only that, there's also a growing body of evidence vis-a-vis the Amazon that indicates that the continuing destruction of these tropical forests is literally disrupting the movement of water in the atmosphere. And if you want to look into this, there was a great article in Yale Environment. All you have to do is Google rivers in the sky, how deforestation is affecting global water cycles. What's going to happen, and what's starting to already show up, is it causes major shifts in precipitation. It could lead to droughts in the major grain-growing areas of the world, in China, in India, and in the U.S. Midwest. So with that preamble, I'll move on to the Barents Sea is sending SOS signals of impending trouble for the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. The Barents Sea, by the way, is located above Norway. It extends over Russia. It then flows into the Kara Sea, Laptev Sea, and the East Siberian Sea. And this is an area that is loaded with subsea methane deposits that could literally change the course of civilization, possibly in our lifetime. I have no way of knowing that, but I know it's possible. And here's why I say the Barents is sending SOS signals. The Barents Sea gets more volume of warmer mid-latitude waters from the Atlantic than any other Arctic Sea. And it's the key portal to all the other following seas, like, you know, the Kara, Laptev, and the East. So what happens in the Barents Sea doesn't stay in the Barents Sea. It's transported across to the others. Now, I found a fascinating story about this unique situation in Dar Jamail's book, The End of Ice. And I highly recommend anyone who has an intense interest in what's happening with our planet and our climate and our ecosystems, buy this book and read it. I'll probably read it 2 or 3 times. I loved it. The reason it's so good is this is boots on the ground journalism. Dar travels to the locations he writes about. He talks to the locals and he talks to the scientists in the field. He gets information you're never, ever, ever going to find in the public domain. Read his book. So anyway, when he traveled to Barov, Alaska, and that's the northernmost town in North America, right on the Arctic coast. By the way, they changed it to the indigenous name, which is now Utqiagvik. Anyway, is everybody there?
Yeah, we're listening. Okay. Fascinating. No, carry on, please.
I keep hearing some background. I didn't know. Anyway, he interviewed the locals, and they told him about these dramatic changes they're seeing, like the coastline is caving in, they have to move houses in and all that. But also he met a very interesting man named Ira Leifer. And Ira Leifer is a scientist. He studies, he's a bubble specialist, in fact. And he studies these shallow Arctic waters, and he does a lot of work with NASA on methane data. And he found that the Barents Sea is sending some very wicked SOS signals. Here's what he discovered. He discovered a very spooky hotspot in the Barents Sea. It's a 620 square mile area. It's jam-packed with methane bubbles. I mean, staggering number. 60 million methane bubbles in a 620 square mile. It must be like champagne bottles going off everywhere. This is a shocker. I mean, literally, it makes your knees fold under to hear this. 60 million of these. Normally, the background rate is, you know, several thousand, not 60 million. It's an ominous signal for these other follow-up Arctic seas. And in fact, Liefer made that statement himself to Dar Gemayel when he talked to him. What's this mean for the East Siberian? Because it's unique. In that regard, in Dar's book, he also mentions the work of Natalia Shikova, who I've mentioned in several articles I've written. She formerly was the head of the International Arctic Research Center at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, by the way, which the governor of Alaska is trying to cut back their funding by 40% through some trickery that is really embarrassing, really embarrassing. Anyway, that's another story. But Natalia Shikova did the seminal work on this area. She's studied it for a couple decades, I think. And she discovered the uniqueness and the obvious threat of the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. In fact, in the public, in public domain, she's actually made statements where she's expressed very deep concerns about the thinning subsea permafrost that holds back what amounts to 15 to 20% of the world's methane hydrates. That's enough to kickstart global warming like you wouldn't believe, and it's enough to totally disrupt civilization as we know it. Here's what's unique about the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. And by the way, this area is so under-researched, it's unbelievable. Everybody thought, boy, you don't have to worry about that one. It's way up there in those northern latitudes where it's so cold, blah, 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 blah. Let's not worry about it. Well, she's kind of bringing things to us to the surface, as are a couple other scientists. Two things make it really unique. One, it's the world's largest undersea shelf. And when I say that, I mean big. It's 1.25 million square miles. That equals Germany, France, Great Britain, Italy, and Japan combined. That's how big it is, okay? Here's the problem with it. It's three times shallower than the mean depth of continental shelves throughout the world. The average depth's only about 50 meters. What that means is if you don't have any ice over the water, like all the Arctic ice is melting off, which otherwise would, you know, you get the albedo effect of the ice reflects about 90% of incoming solar rays back up to outer space. When you don't have the ice, the dark ocean does what? It absorbs 90%. Well, that's what you got going on. Not only that, that's not much of a water column for that methane to escape and not oxidize and go straight into the atmosphere. Now, her research, meaning Natalia Shikova, indicates that you could have a burst or an enormous release of this methane. She said it could occur out of the blue at any time, could happen in a matter of minutes, is what she said once, with one of these 50 gigaton releases. What would that be equal? Well, it would be equal to 1,000 gigatons of carbon dioxide or CO2. And for perspective purposes, since 1850, human influence carbon emitted into the atmosphere has been 1,475 gigatons over 170 years, which means, if you do the math, her 50 gigaton burst would be like 116 years of carbon emissions released all at once. Kind of doubtful the climate system would adjust to that very quickly and very well. You would get enormous, I think, anomalous behavior all over the place, and probably all kinds of burn-off in mid-latitude agricultural areas as a result. I met with Peter Wadhams at Scripps Oceanography a year ago and spent the day with him. He's the professor emeritus from Cambridge who is considered one of the leading scientists on Arctic ice. And I asked him about this Natalia Shikova, you know, suggestion you could get one of these big bursts. And he knows her very well. He went to her wedding. She married another Russian scientist who works with her, whose name I can't think of right now, but anyway, it doesn't matter.
I think his name is Igor Semilitov.
That's it, yes. And she's a lovely lady, he said. Anyway, Peter Wadham said that he really doubts that civilization can survive a 50 gigaton burst. He doesn't know over what time frame, but it would just shake, rattle, and roll the whole climate system so much it messes too many things up. Think about superimposing that over what I said about the Amazon, what's happened there, three times over the last 10 years. Think about that, that drought condition. Liefer also, by the way, moving on here, told Dar that he believes the global climate could easily push past tipping points that means only 1 billion people can live on the planet. Now, that's about the fourth or fifth scientist I've heard say something like that. Kevin Anderson, for example, Tyndale in the UK, said the same thing. And so did the guy who's in charge of Potsdam Institute. They said similar things. So that's kind of where these people are coming from. He also said, and I found this interesting, and this is Liefer again, he said we're already past the point where large portions of the Middle East will become uninhabitable very soon because temperatures are going to be beyond human tolerance. Finally, on this Barents Sea business, I'd like to mention one other thing, and this is a scientist named Charles Miller of NASA, and he said over the last decade, they've witnessed methane vents or plumes in the sea, East Siberian, Arctic shelf, have grown from 1 foot in diameter to over 1/2 mile in diameter within a period of 1 year. And finally, a footnote to all this, methane hydrates were probably the most significant variable in the Permian mass extinction 250 million years ago, which took down 90% of all species. So now I'm going to move on to evidence of a collapsing food web, my second hotspot. And again, I'm going to fall back on Dar Jamail because in his book, The End of Ice, beautiful, fantastic article, he met a guy named Bruce Wright in Alaska, who was a former section chief for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Alaska. And he told a real eye-opener of a story. And here's what it is. Wright said that by 1975, the Gulf of Alaska had already warmed up by 2 centigrade, and scientists were confused about it. As a result, the entire Gulf biological system shifted, and as a result of that, the Alaska Fish and Game Department shut down fisheries to protect what was left. They were freaked out. That was his first real profound experience in the 70s with the impact of global warming. 40 years later, the year 2016, according to Wright, the Gulf warmed up by 15 centigrade in some areas, 15 feet, folks, and overall, the Gulf runs 5 feet above normal, and that's also the Bering Sea all winter long. What are the consequences of this? Well, they've had massive fin whale die-offs, massive halibut die-offs, and when they do catch the halibut now, according to the locals, they're tiny. Not only that, while Dar was there, he heard the Alaskan local news, which was dominated by these reports of huge die-offs of muirs across the entirety of Alaska. Well, muirs are really, they're the northern version of a penguin that flies. And according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department, striking numbers of these died, tens of thousands. They set an all-time record for recorded history of largest die-off ever of these muirs. And what's the cause of that? The water temperatures were so high that it not only caused paralytic shellfish poisoning, but enormous blooms of what they call Alexandrium or algal blooms. And these can be very toxic. In fact, some of the toxins can be more potent than cyanide. And here's what happens in the food web. Sand lance are these forage fish. And what sand lances do, they're like these really tiny pencil-shaped fish. What they do is they eat plankton and they convert it to fat. Well, so they become great targets for everybody else up the food chain. The muir eats sand lances. Well, when they ate them, they're eating toxicity is what happened, because that's what the sand lances had eaten. Not only that, these things are eaten at the bottom of the food web. They're eaten by salmon, by whales, by cod, diving birds like puffins. So that's what's happening to our food web as a result. They've had shocking population declines across the western Alaska of sea otters, of sea lions, of northern fur seals, and of king salmon. Huge portions of that food web have collapsed. Seabirds have literally fallen out of the sky. They wash ashore from Canada to Southern California. And sea lion carcasses that wash up on shore, they're bony. They have all kinds of indications of starvation. In fact, California's crab industry had to shut down for months because of the largest toxic algal bloom ever seen. Now, it's not like history hasn't had examples of these kind of blooms don't happen throughout history. The problem now is they're so much bigger, more frequency, and more intense. And there was an interesting article in National Geographic where they did a study, and they said these very events I'm talking about right now have increased across the globe because of ocean warming.
Robert?
Hello?
Yeah. Can I jump in right there? Most of our listeners are familiar with the collapsing food webs, so maybe you could shorten that a little bit, move on to Fukushima, and give us just a thumbnail sketch. Sorry for the interruption.
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. I was also going to talk about the insect class, but let's just go on to Fukushima then. So I call Fukushima the biggest time bomb in history. And, you know, they say that one nuke meltdown has the impact of 1,000 regular industrial accidents. And that may be conservative, but with Fukushima, we had 3 nuclear meltdowns, not one. And you know, come to think about it, what happens with these nuclear reactors and plants? What are they doing? Why are they there? What's the purpose? It's to boil water. It's to boil water to turn turbines. This whole thing is to boil water. There are all kinds of ways to boil water, by the way. Anyway, they still don't really know, by the way, and this thing happened, 8 years ago now that the meltdown took place. And TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Corporation, and the government, and there's all kinds of underhandedness and hiding of facts taking place on this, by the way. But they still don't really know where that melted core, the corium, really is. They think they've kind of spotted it here and there. You can't go into those reactors. It'll sizzle you to death. And they put robots in, and those get zapped. And sometimes they get little pictures, and they think they see some of the corium. We don't even know if it even melted through the bottom of these reactors yet. We really don't know. It's still a big puzzle. Never been really solved. Now, the biggest, most dangerous issue, though, with nuclear facilities, it's the pools of spent fuel rods. And they all have these spent fuel rods. And according to a study that Princeton did, Fukushima would have been 100 times more worse if they lost the circulating water and the spent fuel pools. Now, keep in mind, those spent fuel pools are all still there. And, of course, the Japanese government and TEPCO 6 years ago or 7 years ago said, well, we're going to start to get those out right away. Well, they haven't yet. They're still there. And keep in mind that Japan is earthquake country. They typically have 400 to 500 earthquakes per year. So according to the head of the Department of Geophysics at Kyoto University, here's what he said about these spent fuel pools. He said, the problem, should it encounter a big earth tremor, it will be destroyed and scatter the remaining nuclear fuel and debris, making Tokyo metro area uninhabitable. And the Tokyo Olympics, tongue-in-cheek, in 2020 will then be utterly out of the question. So what's happened now is that TEPCO has started removing some of these dangerous fuel rods. And this is a dangerous operation from a storage pool in the reactor number 3. There are 4 to 3 different ones that have been knocked out. And the removal process is probably going to take 2 years. It has to be done remotely. They have to do it from a half mile away in a control center via robots. They can't get into these reactors. And then after they do that, they'll have reactors 1 and 2 with another 1,000 fuel rods to remove. So these fuel rods must be kept in these open, deep pools of circulating water, and they must remain there for 10 years to cool down. Thereafter, they're still radioactive for 10,000 years. However, if they make a mistake, if these things get exposed to air, you've got a disaster scenario you wouldn't believe. The radioactivity would be spewing all over the place. And these spent fuel rods are the time bomb I'm referring to. Meanwhile, a couple of other issues on this. TEPCO's running out of logistical space. They've got a nightmare on their hands. They've been removing the topsoil from the Fukushima area and putting it in these big one-ton black bags. Well, they've got 16 million of those bags now. And end-to-end, those would extend from Tokyo to Denver. And the scale on this operation is absolutely huge. 355,000 trucks are used, but nobody wants the bags. They don't know where to put them. Right now, they've got them scattered all over the Fukushima area. This is a huge storage problem, and there are huge potential problems associated with it because the bags are radioactive soil. What if you got some kind of a huge tsunami that comes in and just washes them all out to sea or washes them inland? Or who knows what else could happen? There's a second problem they've got in addition to where they put this radioactive soil, and that's radioactive water. Now they have to keep flowing water over all the hot stuff in these nuclear reactors. Well, they're running out of space now. They have 1,000 of these tanks where they've been keeping the radioactive water. Now they've suggested maybe we should dump it into the ocean. And I think their environmental minister who made that suggestion is that's a trial balloon to see how the public responds to it. I think that's a non-starter, a big non-starter. Greenpeace, by the way, has boots on the ground in Fukushima, and they are extraordinarily critical of what's happening on that entire cleanup operation. They've actually interviewed some of the decontamination workers. Now, keep in mind, what TEPCO has done is they don't use their direct workforce for anything. They use subcontractors to do everything. By the way, that's one of the ways they don't have to report deaths, because it's not them, it's a subcontractor. And that's another thing that's really an ugly scenario. They say there's been one death so far, one person directly as a result of Fukushima. That is total BS. I know of all kinds of people who are independent journalists who've talked to people. We know of Buddhist temples where they've taken in and they've dropped off the remains of decontamination workers, a lot of them. In fact, the mayor of Fatuba actually opened his big mouth a few years ago and said, oh, we've got all kinds of deaths taking place. They just won't let us talk about them.
Another thing that involved with that is that the Yakuza, the Japanese mafia, has been bringing people in to do a lot of those jobs that no one else would do. And they've been using homeless people and poor people. It's just a nightmare at every level.
Well, it's an absolute nightmare. And when Greenpeace talked to some of these decontamination workers, they told them how they cut corners. Because, see, what happens is these subcontractors, they're working by the job. So they have demanding time schedules. What they'll do is they'll say to the workers, well, on the remaining part of this, just rake up the leaves and put those in the bags. We have to meet a time schedule. So here's Greenpeace running around, and they're getting all kinds of hot spots all over the place. Meanwhile, the government of Japan has said, well, all the people who, you know, left the area, you got to move back to your homes, and we're not going to give you any kind of stipends any longer. Listen, the former prime minister, Khan, who was the prime minister when this happened, at one point in time, he said they were within a paper-thin margin of evacuating all of Tokyo. And by the way, there are some geologists and scientists in Japan today who think you may still have an evacuation of Tokyo that may have to happen. But Khan today, the former prime minister, he's a street protester against nuclear power. He's in the streets with the people now. He's not the only one. Kazumi is the same way. And I have a relationship with the former ambassador, Murata, to Europe, and he just put out a book that's published. It's called The Dangers to be Created by the Tokyo Olympics, Clear and Present Radioactivity and Health Damages. He just sent that to me a couple of days ago, the headliners for it. And this is filled with articles by 25 scientists and doctors and refugees of Fukushima talking about what's happening and the dangers associated with it. But I want to move on to one more quick thing regarding all of this nuclear power stuff, and that's this. The nuclear industry really gets away with it big time, because what happens is the effect of radiation is that it accumulates in the human body over time, and that's when it does the damage. It doesn't do it up front. recently, a BBC special report came out, and this is just a couple months ago in July, and the title of it is The True Toll of the Chernobyl Disaster, and I want you to hear this. The official death toll by the AEIE or whoever it is 31 as an immediate result of the Chernobyl meltdown in 1986. Immediate result means you had to be there right at the spot. The UN official death toll is 50. They say directly attributed. Once again, you have to look at the wordsmith here. According to the Russian Academy of Sciences, by the year 2005, which was 14 years ago, somewhere between 112 and 125,000 people were dead because of Chernobyl. According to the Ukrainian cleanup worker death count, they have 11,300. Belarus cleanup worker count, 1,700. Belarus cleanup worker cancer cases because of this, 40,000. There was also an interesting article in USA Today 2 years ago entitled Chernobyl's Legacy, Kids with Bodies Ravaged by Disaster. And this will blow you away. They said there are 2.4 million people registered in Ukraine Health Ministry to receive ongoing Chernobyl-related health care, of which 453,000 are children. None of them were born in 1986 when this happened. Not a one of them. Their parents were kids then. And the range of illnesses that these kids have, they have respiratory problems, digestive, you know, eye diseases, blood diseases, cancer, malformations, genetic abnormalities. There's a woman from Ireland named Russell who visited these children's orphanages in Belarus because they're back in the deep in the forested areas where they have these kids in 2014. And she wrote an article. I'm going to read what she said. Here's what she found. Children rocking back and forth for hours on end, hitting their heads against walls, grinding their teeth, scraping their faces, and putting their hands down their throats. These are kids that were hit by the impact of the radiation from a nuclear disaster before they were born. Before they were born. So now, in the United States, and just a really quick thing about a United States thumbnail sketch for you to understand how dangerous it is in this country, we have 104 nuclear plants. Guess what? Our spent fuel rods in these open pools are almost all the same as what you've got in Fukushima. And here's the problem, one problem among many. But on average, the spent fuel pools here in the United States on these 104 nuclear plants are holding four times more than they were designed to hold. They don't know what to do with this stuff. And a former commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission made the statement about this. He said, the phrase, it can't happen here, is an invitation to disaster. And that's only the half of it, because nuclear power is not going away. There are 450 nukes in the world today in 30 countries, producing only 10% of the world's electricity. 450 nukes that are been built to boil water. 50 are under construction, new ones under construction, 100 more planned, and 300 more proposed. So they're going to double it, take it up to 900. Well, I don't know quite what to say about that other than the world's a dangerous place and it's going to get more so. So those are the key points that I wanted to make.
So, Robert, would you consider nuclear energy the most important topic you've ever worked on? Or if not, then what is the most important topic you've worked on?
Well, that's a great question, Guy. I think for me, from everything I can see, I think it's the most important topic is the impact of human-generated global warming. That's what I think the most, you know, because, see, that's going to spill into the nuclear side as well. You start to have problems heating up the planet, and you're going to have these abortions taking place with nuclear plants all over the place. that'll just double your trouble, won't it?
Yeah, there's no question there's an interaction between climate change and the ability to maintain nuclear facilities. So then what do we do? What is your advice? What do we do in light of this catastrophic knowledge that you're presenting? How do we act, both as individuals and as a society? Can you make recommendations for us about maybe about how you live or how you suggest other people live?
Yeah, I can, Guy. My feeling is that everybody needs to become an eco warrior. You really need to go out and fight this thing and not just sit back and relax and take it. I think that people need to really drill down into it and study it, because your life's at stake along with everybody else's. Everybody needs to become kind of a Greta Thunberg, if you will, out of Sweden. You know, she's kind of a remarkable person. And they need to maybe look into Extinction Rebellion. I think that's an interesting organization that I've already committed funds to. And I think what they're doing is very worthwhile. Let me tell you why. Extinction Rebellion started about a year ago in the UK by some academics out of Oxford and Cambridge. And they have studied this thing probably as much as I have, or more deeper. And they came to the conclusion, we got to do something tomorrow. We can't wait for 10, 15, 20, 30. We got to do it right now. And the only thing you can do, because what happens is you have all these meetings with the IPCC and this meeting and that meeting, the COP meeting here, COP meeting there, conferences, parties. Nothing happens. You know, when I say nothing happens, you're still getting Wally Becker, who is the grandfather of the, he created the saying global warming back when he was at Columbia in graduate school in the 50s, 60s. And he made the statement that, and he died about a year ago, I think, but he made the statement before he died. He said, you know, when I was in graduate school at Columbia, we got, 80% of all of our energy came from fossil fuels and 20% from a bunch of other things. He said, you know, the ratio is the same today. Here we are 50, 60, 70 years later. And of course, the other thing that's happening is you talk about this inflection point of the year 2000. Well, what's happened since 2000? Well, what's happening is that the amount of carbon into the atmosphere is up about almost 30-40% from the year 2000. So we're not going backwards, we're going forwards by just spewing more and more and more. I think you really have to become kind of a mean SOB with this thing and go after it. And now let me tell you about, I was going to tell you about the Extinction Rebellion and why I think that's important. When they first had their first demonstration, and what they do is they do everything peacefully, and they blocked Parliament and they blocked different businesses and things. Only, I forget the percentage, it was a small percentage of people in the UK thought we had a climate emergency. After their first several demonstrations, that number went up to 67% in the UK. And not only that, but now there are 90 communities, towns and cities in the UK that have committed to be carbon free by the year 2025. That's the target that the Extinction Rebellion has set for getting rid of all fossil fuels. And they're putting their reputations in on the line, because if you get arrested these days in the kind of governments that we got around the world, which are filled with thugs nowadays, you know, your career can be ruined. But they're willing to go out on a limb. Now, there are some cells for the Extinction Rebellion starting here in the United States, and I think you're going to see more of it. But I think you've really got to, you know, go after it one way or another. Just don't. I don't think we can sit back idly and just let it happen. I don't want to be a defeatist about it, and that's one thing, Guy, that bothers me a little bit about your work and what you say. I've listened to several of your speeches, and I admire a lot of things you say. And the problem is, so much that you say is so true that it's kind of scary. But what comes through in that is kind of a defeatist attitude that we really don't have anything left but love, and we have to sit back and kind of let it happen to us. And I kind of disagree with that, to be honest with you. I'd rather say, let's go fight and see if we can make a change, make a difference. You know where I'm
I disagree with that, too. In fact, Robert, I would challenge you to find any 100 people who have made as much of a sacrifice as I have. You know, I voluntarily opted out of the monetary system when I realized that's what was driving the whole system and therefore driving us to extinction. I opted out of that system 10 and a half years ago. I lived off grid for the next 10 years, literally defecating in a bucket. Have you done that? Has anybody you know done that? Have 1,000 other people done that? No. And then I realized that because of something called the aerosol masking effect, which most people are unfamiliar with because paid climate scientists won't talk about it, neither will the government, neither will corporations. Because I reached an understanding of the aerosol masking effect and its importance, I realized that it was a better use of my time to educate people than it was to set an example by living differently, by trying to opt out of the system known as civilization, in which essentially nobody followed me anyway.
Yeah.
So I'd like to return to what I think you know better than anybody we've ever had on this show, and that is the role of the Fourth Estate. As a journalist and as part of the Fourth Estate, what is the role of the Fourth Estate in this whole interacting, cascading series of environmental failures? And so what is the role of the Fourth Estate? And as part of the Fourth Estate, what is your role in that whole system?
Okay. Well, number one, the Fourth Estate has been hijacked by the plutocratic transnational capitalist class. And I wrote an article about transnational elites in 2012 called The New Transnational Elite. And what that means is this transnational capitalist class, these are the plutocrats of the world, and they have no allegiance or loyalties to any nation state. And increasingly, they could care less about the people, the average people in any given country. And they all know each other, and they all meet at the same places. They all meet at the World Economic Forum in Davos. They all meet at the Bilderberg Group annual geopolitic forum. They all meet in the BOA forum on China's Hana Island. They all meet at the Aspen Institute's Ideas Festival and at Herb Allen's Sun Valley Gathering for Media Moguls, and also at the Google Siteguest conference. So they have really taken control of the world, whether you realize it or not, because they all get together and talk about all these things. But that Fourth Estate you're talking about, which is the journalistic side of what's happening in the world, has been hijacked by them. And don't we all know who owns all the media anyway? It's all part of what I've just talked about. So what I've kind of cut up, what I've done for my own personal satisfaction, in a way, is I've decided that, I believe what George Orwell said. He said, in a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. So I kind of think like I've become a little bit of a revolutionary, because what I'm trying to do is seek the truth about something that there's not a lot of truth about out in the public media. And I've taken it upon myself to do that. And as a result, I put out an awful lot of articles and done a ton of research. And I do read primary science research all the time. And I'm going to just keep doing that and making as much of an exposure to the public as I can. But you will notice that my articles don't fit in with this transnational elite group that controls the Forbes magazine, for example. I can't believe the number of articles in Forbes that are apologetic for nuclear power. It's amazing to me. They are such apologists, they fall all over themselves. Well, you find that through all of the, you know, the common media that we've got, the mainstream media, and once again, I think it's all controlled by this elite transnational class. They all get together. You can bet they talk about these things. There are a couple people in some of these that run some of these. This is interesting. That run some of these conferences I've talked about that contacted me, interestingly, and I don't know where this goes yet, but they run all of my articles, which I send to them, and I found that kind of amusing. I think, I don't know what that means really, but anyway, I'm kind of rambling
Robert,
on.
We're actually going to have to draw this to a close. We're coming very close to the end of our hour now. I'd like to thank you very, very much for coming on board and giving us your time. With regard to the Extinction Rebellion movement, I'd like to quote, you'll probably know about the work of Jim Bendel and his paper Deep Adaptation.
I read one of the things.
Sorry, go on. Yep.
Yeah.
You know him? One of the things that Jim Bendel said is, and I'll quote, getting busy with action can be a distraction from full acceptance of our predicament. And I think what he was trying to say is that, you know, us lobbying politicians isn't going to be effective. And I think we really need to start preparing for the new world that's unfolding in front of us now. Hey, that's pretty much the end of our show now. I'd like to thank our contributors and listeners today, as well as AfroZen for our theme music. You can catch NBL on PRN the first Tuesday afternoon of the month at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our next episode airs on November the 5th, 2019. If you miss the broadcast, you can find the shows in our archives at prn.fm, the Podbeam, and at Stitcher. Feel free to rate us on iTunes. Thank you so much for your time, Robert. It was an absolute pleasure. Mother.